Good morning, everyone. Thank you for welcoming me here. It's great to be among you and a privilege to have been able to share yesterday with you about something that is a passion of mine, which is care for creation. And so I'll be continuing that a little bit today, as well as giving some thoughts about the concept of hope and how we can continue being people of hope in the midst of many reasons not to be hopeful. So first, I'll share a little bit about what brings me here to you all. So, and I think that actually I'm supposed to excuse the children, so the children can go to their places of worship at this point. It's good to see the children worshiping amongst us, and I hope you have an enjoyable time together. So I grew up a Quaker in Oregon, in Newburgh, and I am currently a member of North Valley Friends. And so as I grew up, I attended an unprogrammed meeting at first, and so my family and several other families started an unprogrammed meeting in Newburgh, Oregon, and we went there for the first 11 or so years of my life. I always appreciated this time in the service when I got to exit the silent worship space, but learned to be still among friends and listen for the Spirit together. And then when I was about 11 or 12, my parents thought that it would be good for us to go to a program meeting because they had a youth group, so there were more kids there to hang out with. And so I spent time at a programmed meeting for most of the rest of my life, and during my growing up years did a lot of activities with youth, and then as I got into college, youth ministry and camping ministry and that sort of thing among friends. And those were important formative parts of my life, and especially during high school I was kind of wrestling with whether or not Christianity was meaningful, whether or not Quakerism was the right place for me to be, and really found the present Spirit in the scriptures and in the traditions that we know as friends, and in the lives particularly of those friends that we hear about their social justice actions in the past. And so I became a convinced friend at that time of learning our history and feeling that this was the home where I fit the best, where I'm feeling called. And I wondered, what is the social justice issue of our time? And so I spent a lot of time seeking about that and looking in the Bible and looking at all of the social justice causes around the world, of which there are many. And long story short, ended up noticing the environment and the climate change situation and feeling like all of the other social justice causes that we might stand up for are incredibly important, and they're not going to be much use if we don't have a healthy and safe place in which for human communities to thrive and continue to participate in the rest of the natural world that we need in order to live healthily. So that has become something that I've been really called to continue working on, both in practice and in my academic work and in my ministry. And I'm clerking Sierra Cascade's yearly meeting and trying to get that kind of off the ground. And so as a clerk of that yearly meeting and as a member of North Valley Friends, I bring greetings to you all from friends in Oregon and Washington. So thank you for allowing me to be here and share with you today. So The scripture reading that I have for today is kind of a strange one for sharing about being stewards of the vineyard, sharing about creation, care, and hope. So bear with me as we look at this passage. There we go. So this is Matthew 21, 33 through 40. Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a watchtower. Then he leased it to tenants and went to another country. When the harvest time had come, he sent his slaves to the tenants to collect his produce, but the tenants seized his slaves and beat one, killed another, and stoned another. Again, he sent other slaves, more than the first, and they treated them in the same way. Finally, he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and get his inheritance." So they seized him, threw him out of the vineyard, and killed him. Now when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? They said to him, "He will put those wretches to a miserable death and lease the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the produce at the harvest time." And so often we think of this parable in the sense of people who don't recognize the Messiah, who don't recognize God at work in the world. And it's easy for us to place that on those other people over there, those people who miss the work of God in the world. And I invite us today to look at this as, where are we in this story? Can we see ourselves in those tenants? Where are we missing the work of God in the world? And where are we doing the work trying to do the work ourselves instead of listening to what God is calling us to? And there's another thing about this that I want us to notice, which is that in addition to many other parables, this takes place in a place, right? It has a physical location that it is grounded in, and it's that vineyard. And the people, the tenants, are called to be stewarding that for the landlord. And they're called to be taking care of it and to be sending some of the produce back to the landowner. And they're not doing a very good job of that, right? So I want us to think about this in the sense of ourselves being those tenants. And how are we doing at stewarding this vineyard? And so so as I think about this, I invite you to take a moment to look internally. So take a moment and close your eyes and look internally at those places in yourselves where, and open up those places in yourselves where you need to be listening to God on this. And keep yourself in that space of prayer and openness. And I invite you to imagine the landowner giving this vineyard to some new tenants. And imagine that this vineyard is out in Napa County, pretty close to here, where the previous tenants have not done a great job of keeping it up. But it's got a good infrastructure. And you go by the piece of land and you fall in love with it. And you're so excited about the prospect of taking care of that land and making some really great wine there. And you meet the landowner. And you tell about all your dreams for that place to the landowner. And the landowner invites you to come and partner with caring for that space. And even says that the landowner will come and be there with you and help you learn. And so you move in, maybe you and a few other people who are your community. And you have a vision for what this place is going to be like. But you actually have no idea how to run a vineyard, how to make wine. And day after day, you work alongside the landowner. You read things, everything that this landowner has written on the subject of vineyards and winemaking. You watch the landowner's hands pruning those vines. You watch the weather to see when is the time for picking the grapes. You hear the landowner's stories about previous year's vintages that have been amazing and the ones that have been terrible. And the landowner listens to some of your own ideas and lets you try them out And sometimes they turn out really well. Sometimes they fail spectacularly. The seasons pass and your children grow up there and hear the stories from the landowner and from you. And new stories are created. Imagine your family growing up and being nourished by and nourished on that land. So go ahead and open your eyes. I don't know about you, but this second way of reading this parable gives me a lot of hope. A lot more hope. I don't see a lot of huge difference between the old tenants and the new tenants, except for maybe that they're teachable and they're open. At least for me, I notice there are days when I feel like those old tenants and I try to do everything myself and keep all the glory for myself and knock down the other people who maybe have a message from God. And then some days I'm open and I recognize how clueless I am about how to steward this vineyard, but I listen and I watch and I learn. So the old tenants, out of fear, locked down their land, struggled on their own to try to produce what they could from this land that wasn't theirs, and refused to give even a drop to the landowner. But the new tenants faced life with joy and passion. So this story brings me a lot of hope, and I've been focusing on hope lately in my studies because as I study environmental care, I need some hope. I don't know about you. And so today, for the rest of this time, we'll be talking about three things. Hope in the Hebrew prophets particularly, and a little bit in the Christian Testament. Hope, what hope is from various backgrounds and disciplines, and then applying hope to the environmental situation that we're in. So first, hope and the prophets. So I've felt for a long time that Quakers are kind of a people of prophets, and that's something that we get accused of both positively and negatively. So when I read an article a while back that talked about climatologists as the prophets of our time, crying doom and destruction like biblical prophets in some ways, I was excited and interested and thought this was a good way of thinking about the prophets. But then I got thinking about the full role of a prophet. There's the doom and gloom part, but there's also the part about offering hope to the people. A vision of a time that it won't be all death and destruction. And this part of the prophetic role is based firmly in a personal knowledge of God and God's work in our lives and our history. So you see Isaiah offering hope and consolation toward the end of Isaiah after he's talked about the whole vine of Israel being cut off, and then he talks about a shoot growing up out of that stump. Ezekiel has all these scary prophecies about the destruction of the temple and God's presence leaving, but then he talks about God calling him to preach to the valley of the dry bones, representative of the people who are all dried up and dead due to lack of hope. Ezekiel is to prophesy to them, and the flesh returns. And God says through him, I will put my spirit within you. You shall live, and I will place you on your own soil. Then you shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken and will act, says the Lord. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, still manages to talk about hope for the remnant and reminds the people that God gives them hope and a future, and that they are not there to plant trees even in exile, to live for the fullest possible goodness, even of that culture that exiled them. And then in the book of Revelation, when John is having his prophetic vision of an apocalyptic death and destruction, his vision ends with a tree of life and a river flowing from it. Notice how all these are very physical and land-based metaphors. a vine with a living shoot, being placed in our own soil, planting an orchard as a sign of active hope for a good future, a tree and a river symbolizing life. It seems like God's words to the prophets are very physical, connecting the health of the community with the land. The role of the prophet is not just to tell us what's wrong with the world, but also to give us an alternative vision for the future. All right, so the prophetic role has to do with bringing hope, but what exactly is hope, right? So I studied this in several different disciplines because I wondered what different people had to say about hope. And so when you look at psychological understandings of what hope is, they bring some help to the situation of wondering, what is this thing? So they talk about hope consisting of a goal. So you have to have a goal that you're looking forward to. That's what you're hoping for. And being able to think about the steps that we can take to get to that hope. We can imagine ourselves having the motivation or the sense of agency to move in that direction. So psychologists think of hope as a cognitive process, something that we do in our minds and have to think through those steps, something we do rationally. We calculate our chances of whether or not we can attain that goal and then decide whether or not to move towards it. So philosophers have noticed, however, that hope is rarely so systematic and rational. Why do people hope in things that aren't very likely to happen? Why do we hope to beat the odds if we're sick with a terminal disease? Why do we root for the underdog? And it seems that hope is not exactly based on a highly rational process or a high likelihood of our desired outcome. When we know the reality of a situation, if there's a glimmer of a chance that the thing we hope for might happen, sometimes we choose to focus on that possibility. And hope is different from wishful thinking, because if there's no chance of it happening, that's just wishful thinking. Or if it definitely will happen, that's certainty. So hope is that between 1 and 99% of a chance of something happening. All right, and then I'll mention some of the terms for hope that are used in the Hebrew Bible and a little bit in the Christian Testament, because I think they help us elucidate what hope is beyond philosophy and psychology's thinking on this. So there are a couple of words, well, there are several words that we translate hope from the Hebrew Bible, because hope in English has kind of a range of meanings, and it's not always the same as the Hebrew terms that are being used. But the main two words that are used for hope are yachal, or tohelet, and kava or tikva. So those are the verb and the noun forms. So kava and tikva refers to hope that one has within one's time span, one's own lifespan, the human life. And it has to do with the hope of a long life that is fulfilling and lived ethically in right relationship. So that's a kind of personal hope, and I think that's kind of what the psychologists are talking about, of hope for your own life that you can live in such a way that you will be glad about it by the end, that you can work toward a particular goal, in this case of living ethically and faithfully and having a long life, hopefully. And then there's a second kind of hope called yachal or tohelet, and this requires an object that one is waiting for or expecting, which is usually God, so you're hoping or expecting for God to do something. And this word has a continuous nature, so that it refers to waiting on God in a sustained way, and so not necessarily contained within your own lifetime. And we as friends might call this holy expectancy. Thomas Kelly uses that term, and I love that. It's this holy expectancy, this holy longing and waiting for God, that part of it is just waiting and being in God's presence, which is something that we do when we are still together and waiting on God. And part of it is this broader hope and longing and waiting and expectancy for God to do what God has promised within human history at some point. And this is the kind of hope that we need when we are acting around environmental concerns, right? Because most of us may not live to see all of the impacts that humans have caused, the negative impacts on this planet, be reversed. Most of us will not live long enough to see climate change be going back in a positive direction. But we hope that we can be part of that process of reconciling ourselves and God's creation in positive directions. And so it's this extended and long-term kind of hope, that this holy expectancy, this waiting, but it's a continuous waiting and it's an active waiting. It's not just sitting around and hoping that God is going to do something, but it's a process, it's a something that we're actively involved in. And I won't go into the Greek word on this very much, but it's elpis, and the Christian Testament authors use this Greek word elpis to mostly mean that yachal word, the long-term continuous type of hope. And it's different from the Greek way of expressing this term, so if you want to know more about the etymology, I can let you know later, but I'll leave it at that for now. But they invite us into that same kind of long-term hope. Now, how do we apply this to the environmental situation? People talk about hope as a practice. It's something that we have to practice and do kind of on a daily basis. It's a choice we make in full knowledge of reality. So with that psychological perspective in mind, you have to know what reality is and the likelihood of your hoped-for thing happening. So we practice being aware of what reality is, and then we practice envisioning something for the future. What do we want the future to look like? What does that kingdom of God look like in our future imagining? So we spend time imagining what that would look like if we lived in that reconciled world. And it's not this optimism like, oh, this is going to be all great and everything's going to turn out all right. But it's a deep awareness of the reality of the problems that we face and choosing to hope. And this isn't something that we can really do very well by ourselves, because it's hard to maintain that kind of a sense of long-term and continuous hope on our own, right? So that's why we need each other. And when we come together as a community, it helps us to be able to hold on to that hope in healthier ways and to be reminded of it. And when we're not feeling it on a certain day, we're carried along by the community that is holding that hope together with the rest of us. But sometimes it's hard to hope, isn't it? Why don't we hope sometimes? I think we don't hope because it's too painful. It's letting all that hope in day after day and seeing that it doesn't happen. Continuing to practice hope in the face of that day after day failure is hard work. And I think that's why we tell each other stories. Stories help us imagine that different world, and they also help us remember God's faithfulness in the past. So we can see ourselves moving around in the future world and envision what it will look like. So hope is for the future, but I think it requires an orientation toward the past. We have to have a sense that we've been able to move in a positive direction before and accomplish goals in the past, so that gives us a measure of assurance that we can do so again. So as Quakers, we like to tell ourselves stories about our Quaker history of people in the past who have stood up for social justice causes and made a big difference in the world. And that's a way of helping us to have hope that we too can be people like that. We too can be faithful in our time and place. And when we read the Bible, we can read about the good things that God has done in the past and the faithful people who have listened to God in those times. And it also helps us to have modern examples. So I'll give a few of those. So one of the examples that I actually give when I talked at other places is the city of San Francisco. So I think that should be hopeful to you all, that you have a zero waste by 2020 goal, I believe. I watched a documentary on it, so it must be true. So your city is implementing, or at least San Francisco, I'm not sure how Berkeley fits into all that, but in your region, you have these great goals and you're implementing them in a lot of really excellent ways toward caring for the planet. So you're doing curbside composting and sending that back to farms that are local and having the produce from those local farms come back in to feed the community. And you're finding out new and better ways to recycle plastic more locally, at least on a small scale, and electronic waste. And you're providing more local jobs through those ways of learning how to recycle things here, and that provides jobs for people here. And I think it also gives a sense of honor and respect for the people who gather your trash and recyclables, because they're helping your community to meet those goals. And so even though the people that gather our waste are not always respected by our communities today, it gives a sense of dignity to those people who are helping the community meet those goals. So I think that's a really great example and something hopeful. At least it gives me hope and other communities hope to see the work that you all are doing. So thank you. Yesterday I talked about a concept called watershed discipleship, and it's this idea that we as Christians are in this moment of environmental concern and to some extent crisis, and that we need to learn how to be disciples within our watersheds, disciples in our places. So when we became a community of Christians who were trying to take this message everywhere, we became displaced, right? We're not placed in the land anymore. We don't have a particular place that is sacred or special to us, and that has its positives. We can worship anywhere, right? But it also has its negatives. We're disconnected from our places. We can move on whenever that community is no longer welcoming, or in a lot of cases now, no longer has the resources that we want to consume. And so we've been practicing that for a long time, unfortunately, as a Western culture, of moving to the next place that has resources, depleting those resources, and moving on. But now we don't have that luxury anymore, because we've used a lot of the resources and we have spread out across the whole planet. So how do we learn again to become disciples within the places where we live and care for those places? So we're learning that again, and people learning that are using the term watershed discipleship. So there are many examples of great ways that people are doing this watershed discipleship in their communities. So there's an example of a church in Portland called the Wilderness Way Community, and they have monthly times that they go outside to a particular location and pray there and spend their worship time there, and then several times throughout the year where they help with restoration and conservation projects on that same land. It's a city park, a big one. There's a community out in North Carolina that is partnering with other local groups to care for the watershed, and the pastor there helps resolve disputes between landowners and environmentalists when they kind of butt heads about the ways that we should conserve our rivers and that sort of thing. So helping be a reconciling presence within that community to help people to recognize that this is important for all of us, not just for the environmentalists who are trying to ruin our ability to make a living, or the other way around, where we can think of people who are, you know, trying to destroy the environment just to make a buck. So instead of having those two, disparate ways of viewing the situation, bringing those together and helping reconcile that community. And there are a lot of other examples of people like that who are doing good work in their communities to try to bring reconciliation between people and land as an expression of their faith and their rootedness in place. So although it sometimes feels like our little actions are not very much, and what can our little changes do to fix the things, the huge problems that we see, in other ways, this is the best way that we can enact change. So I was talking with your very own Giuseppe the other day, And he was talking about nuclear armament and doing protests against that. And I asked if it felt like it did any good to go there year after year to protest. And he said, for those who gather, it brings hope that we're not alone. And this is part of the way that hope works, isn't it? Even though the process is long and it can feel at times like we're not accomplishing much, we're holding the space of hope for one another. And at times, God's Spirit breaks through in powerful ways. The arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. Joanna Macy, who wrote a book called Active Hope, imagined hope like a newspaper photo, where if you look at it with a magnifying glass, you just see all these little tiny dots, and they're meaningless by themselves, right? But if you zoom out and you see the whole picture, the picture emerges and it makes sense, and there's meaning. And without each of those dots, the picture wouldn't be the same. So as we do those little acts of faithfulness, we're helping that picture to emerge. I love this quote that is attributed to Margaret Mead. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And as friends, we have seen that time and again in our history, that this small, tiny little denomination has influenced the direction of history in so many ways. So here's your group of committed, thoughtful people joining with other similar groups from all over the country and the world based on your faith and what God has done in us and through us in the past, looking forward to the future with hope. So to sum up, the role of the prophet is to cast a vision for the future, a vision that contains the brutal reality that we're in, but that also grounds us in how God has worked in the past in order to give us hope for the future. Hope is a choice that we make, and we make it daily, but not alone. It's like a spiritual practice, choosing to see reality and also choosing to see the steps in the direction of our hoped-for goal, and holding one another through that process when we can't do it ourselves. Hope is often based on sharing our stories. When we hear stories of others who have taken steps towards the same goals, we too find we have the motivation to move forward. And it's important to celebrate. So when you do make a step in the direction of your hope, celebrate that and bring it forward to the group to say, we did this thing, and celebrate it together. So each of us gets to choose which kind of tenant we're going to be. Are we going to be the ones who shut down and violently reject all hope, choosing to act out of fear? Or are we going to be the ones that open up vulnerably to share what we do know, working alongside the Master Vintner together and sharing our stories? So I leave you with this quote from Dorothy Day. People who say, "What is the sense of our small effort?" They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. So what kind of steward will I be?